get started. We can give Gokiko a few minutes to get here while I talk. So please make eye shot. May the sacred presence of the one who said he would abide in his teaching be our guide. May we follow his glorious example and tread with unfaltering steps this noble path until we too shall attain enlightenment. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. So are there any announcements?
Is everybody here on our mailing list so you receive the weekly e-bulletins? No? If you're not... Yes, if you're not, please...
I'll just pass it around.
Yes. He's going to pass... Fujaka's going to pass it around. Sign the guest book and put your email down so that you do get our weekly bulletins. And the announcement, the main announcement I would make for this week is that on Saturday night, starting at 8 o'clock, yes?
Yes.
Until Sunday morning at...
6:45.
Thank you. is the Founders Vigil. So this weekend is when we recognize the founders of our temple, and we have sitting all night long, beginning at 7 until 6:45, or 8 until 6:45 in the morning. You can come for any part of that. You can come at 8 o'clock and sit, you know, for half an hour, 45 minutes. You can come at 2 o'clock in the morning. You can come for the whole thing. So that's the sort of the big event of this weekend.
And I would also like to add that there's a Dogen workshop earlier that day. I think it's 9:30 today.
It's 10 to 5:30.
10 to 5:30.
Yeah.
You have to register for it.
You need to register for that. Sign up is online, the link is online, and it's $30, so I mean it's not super expensive, but it's Sato will be teaching it, and for any of you who studied Dogen in the past, she's doing something a little different. I think it'll be interesting to see a different approach to Dogen. I have a feeling that it will be a little more accessible than sometimes Dogen can be, as much as Dogen can be.
We're going to do a lot of copying.
Yeah,
there's going to be a variety of activities
involved with it. So it'd be pretty interesting if you've got some time and having some of those writings. So
did you mention that the Zendo will be open on Tuesday?
Oh, forgot about that.
I don't know about that.
We're making it available if people need respite.
might get a more on Wednesday.
Yes. Well, we're up on Wednesday too. But there is
the sums and lines are open.
Yes. So there is a class on Tuesday night, which will still be happening here, but the Zendo will be open for anyone who wants to sing.
Anytime during the day.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so I already...
We did the verse.
Yeah, did the verse. Yes.
And you've got the first part. So.
I have the first part. Okay. I
didn't.
Okay, so we're going to start off with the six realms. And I have a little bit of a visual aid. I seem to be missing two pages of my notes, so could get a little interesting. A little way in, but hopefully we'll be... get going by then, and you won't even notice. So, this is a visual representation of what we're going to be talking about. First thing that you can notice about this is that it is a circle. It's got heaven at the top and hell at the bottom, but it's not a ladder. It's not something that you go up and down. It's a circle and a wheel that you would somehow traverse going around it. It's called... this is something, iconography that exists across all Buddhist traditions pretty much, but it the exact number of realms and exactly you know, the stories about them are not exactly the same. But this is like the base... I think this is pretty much the base set of things. I think if you get this, you'll have a pretty good grasp on how it is supposed to go. What you see here is Yama, Lord of the Underworld, that's the fearsome orange person here, holding up the wheel. And Yama, the story is that Yama appears at death and holds up a mirror that is empty. And that mirror reflects samsara, it reflects this world of here and now, and we project onto that what our lives were. So it's not anybody judging us, it's us making an evaluation ourselves about what our life has been. And around the outside of the circle, right around this green rim, are little pictures representing the 12 steps of dependent origination, which I don't have to explain now because we're going to talk about it next week. So, and around the inside, there are three animals, a bird, a snake, and an ox or something. I don't know. Depends. Let's see. What do they call it?
A rooster, a snake, and a pig.
Yeah. Pig, snake, bird, delusion. Okay, I know what they represent. They represent the three poisons, greed, hate, and delusion. And those are the things that power the wheel. Those are the things that keep the wheel turning. So this can be interpreted as a story about reincarnation, but as we said last week in our tradition, we consider that we're reborn every minute. So we can actually make a full cycle of this circle every day. And you don't necessarily go from one to the other in a neat pattern. You can sort of jump around and land in different spots during it. So we're going to go through all six of them. And see if I'm leaving anything out. Starting with heaven, which is at the top, this heaven is not nirvana. Nirvana is outside of this wheel of karma. It's stepping off the wheel and not being totally caught by it. So this heaven realm, which is at the top, is it's the realm of the where the devas live. It's a place of bliss and abundance. The devas are godlike, but they don't live forever. They just live for a very, very long time in total bliss and abundance. And pretty much everything goes the way that they would like it to. That heaven realm is subdivided into six or more main realms, or less, and those realms are subdivided. So there's quite rich imagery behind this that if you're interested in, please, you know, like, take a look at it. Some of the things, so there are different grades of devas and different levels within heaven. Kind of a list of things I pulled out that give you a feeling for what it's like there is that the devas never sweat or feel discomfort. They're in perfect health. They give birth spontaneously without troubles of pregnancy or labor. Children appear magically at age 5.
Skip those early.
Doesn't happen. And child rearing is a collective endeavor, so no one person is on the hook for all of it all the time. They pretty much have superpowers. Their wishes become reality. Plus, in some levels of Deva heaven realm, they don't even have to make things happen that they want. There are other devas whose job it is to anticipate what they want and make it happen for them. So, you know, they're pretty set. sexual desires are aroused and fulfilled by a mere glance. So, you know, well, what's wrong with that, right? They're not very aware. They're not very self-aware. They don't have a lot of compassion or generosity going on. And, you know, that kind of makes sense because they're with other devas that don't need anything from them unless their job is to anticipate the wishes of other devas. But the only time that they are really self-aware is when they first get to this place and then when they're leaving. The way that one gets to the heaven realm is by making a sincere effort in your life and in your practice, not doing a lot of harm. That merit eventually gets used up. It's conditioned, and so it's temporary, like everything. And so eventually, a being's time in the heaven realm is over. And when that starts to happen, there are some telltale signs. They stop smelling good. And so the other devas don't want to go anywhere near them. And so that's when they start to become self-aware. They're going, wait, you know, wait, I want, you know, like, and that is the beginning of the end of when they start to slide into, usually they slide into the next realm down at that point. In each one of these realms, that's what I don't have. Is that right? In each one of these realms, there is a Buddha in a circle, or Bodhisattva, holding something. And the thing that they're holding is the way out of that realm. Okay, all right, there it is. So in the heaven realm, it's a white Buddha holding a musical instrument. And that's gently draw them down from their distractions and awaken them from complacency. So the way to avoid getting dumped into an unpleasant realm, because it does feel bad to be wrenched from this beautiful environment when there's nothing but, like, you know, music and art and all kinds of loveliness. So a way to avoid that is through awakening a sense of compassion and awareness and generosity toward other beings. However, if that doesn't work, you end up in the Asura realm, which is basically envy and dissatisfaction. So that's the second one down right here. And the Asuras are, they're not gods, but they want to be. And many of them were in the heaven realm recently, so they know what it's like, and they're not there anymore. So they're pretty unhappy. The Asura realm is a place of jealousy and competitiveness and strife and aggressiveness. These guys are fierce demigods. They're obsessed by what they don't have, and they fight with the other devas and with themselves. There is a tree that has its roots in the Asura realm that is the wish-fulfilling tree that bears fruit in the heaven realm. So they can see into the heaven realm, and they know what's going on, and they just spend all their time trying to, like, figure out.
There's a little guy with an axe there about to cut it down. He's so mad.
And I was kind of interested to find out that they, a lot of, when they're not busy fighting and you know, trying to overthrow heaven, a lot of times they put on a very, like, they appear to be very law-abiding and just and, like, you know, doing things. They appear to be very upstanding. But you can't really trust that. I had a little excerpt I was going to read about this place. So In battles against the devas, the asuras have a terrible disadvantage. After magically arousing their own aggression, the devas assemble, led by Indra. Indra rides on an immense elephant named Supremely Steady. The elephant has 33 heads. Indra rides on the central one, and his ministers ride on the other 32. The devas form an unimaginably large army and raise a mighty battle cry as they rain weapons down on the asuras. Huge arrows, spears, thunderbolts, and wheels. The devas use their powers to pick up entire mountains and hurl them down on the asura army. At times, the devas may be driven back to the gates of the city of Lovely in the heaven of the 33. But in the end, the asuras are hopelessly outmatched. Devas are 7 times larger than humans and can only be killed when their heads are cut off, and can heal all of their other wounds with divine ambrosia. Asuras, on the other hand, are smaller and die as easily as humans. So these guys are too busy for spiritual practice, obviously. The way that you land in Asura realm is through harboring resentment and jealousy. So it's not terrible things. It's just kind of like this realm is kind of a manifestation of if you want to harbor resentment and jealousy, this is getting a chance to really like act it out. And their Buddha is a green Buddha armored with a sword to slice through delusion. So the recommended course of action for them is to develop self-discipline to hold in some of their aggression and to use their power to maintain order and justice for all. And there's also a recommendation about gratitude, to develop gratitude for what they have, because what they have isn't bad. They just always want more of this heavenly realm. So that's Asuras. I think too, like what they're concerned with is self-preservation, and underlying they have like a disappointment and sadness about life, which kind of humanizes them when I hear that. Are there any questions about those two so far?
What are you reading from? Just
okay, yeah, this is really excellent resource on it's called The Buddhist Teaching of the Six Realms, and it's by Domio Sater. So Domio, right, I was reading, but yeah, Domio Burke, who is a priest trained here at Dharma Rain. Looks like it's privately printed. I can find out if there's any availability, but it's
out actually pretty much, so I need to get them reprinted.
Well, there you go. Thanks. But this is a great resource if you want to read some more of the stories.
And where did the stories originally come from?
Originally?
She has sources that she cites in the back of this little book.
There are Tibetan sources. There are Indian sources going back to the Buddhist time.
And before.
Yeah.
So a lot of this was adopted from pre-Buddhist stuff.
So after the Asura realm, is the realm of the animals or beasts. And this is one that a lot of people say, well, what's wrong with that? I mean, they're really just concerned with physical and sensual desires. It's a place of ignorance, just following their desires and aversions. Pretty much all they care about is food, drink, shelter, safety, mating. There are many different types of beasts or animals. So depending on what type of person you are, you can manifest different qualities in this realm. There are predators, who just happily slay each other because I'm hungry. There are carrion eaters who feast on things that have already died. And there are lethargic bovine kind of animals that just chomping on their cud happily. The way that you get in this realm is by acting without regard to moral laws, willful ignorance. And a way out is to cultivate ethical conduct. There, Buddha is a blue Buddha holding up a book of scripture. So that is a recommendation for understanding, letting go of stubbornness, gaining that wider view that they don't have. You know, it can be sound not that bad to just like concentrate on food, drink, and sex, but that's all they have. You know, there's none of the art, none of the beauty. They're just kind of like in the muck, and that can be okay for a while too, but if that's all you have, it can kind of run out its fun. Yes.
So are like beings reincarnated into that particular realm as animals then?
That's one way to look at it.
Okay.
Yeah, so there's two views. One of them that is just talking about actual reincarnation. And back in the Buddha's day, when belief, and I hope I'm not stepping on your topic, but back, you know, when reincarnation was a common belief, it probably kept some people in line to believe that they might be reborn as animals if they didn't behave themselves. And so, you know, there's some practical application for having that belief. But like I said, the way that we look at it is that these are states of mind and being, and that you can be in one, you know,
okay,
now, today, tomorrow, whatever.
I often find that it's interesting to think about the people that I know who I can observe, or myself at various times in my life when I've been in the Asura realm or in the animal realm. It's like, oh yeah, you know, I really wasn't paying any attention. I was just kind of like dancing along, not thinking about anything, you know. Or I was really, really pissed off. I was really trying to get my own thing. And, you know, you can kind of see that the way people manifest.
It's sometimes easier to see in other people.
Yes, it is. Definitely. Much easier.
Especially the ones that you don't like that much. I mean, you know. But, I mean, I've made it a practice sometimes to see, try to see it in myself.
Oh, I know. Her problem.
Yeah. So next up is Hell Realm, and that's the one at the bottom, and that kind of completes the downward cycle part of this. It's the full fury of negative karma. It's the turning point to the upward path. As I said, it's like hitting bottom. There are extremely well-documented accounts of the torments. I mean, there's more written about the hell realm than there is about any of the other realms. People really like to get into that. There are hot hells and cold hells. Torments include being pierced with hot iron, sliced with axes, burned with fire. There are many levels in the hell realm. Two characteristics. One is all-consuming torment, and the second one is repeated dashing of hope that you will ever get out of there, or that there is any hope. Domio has a
so those of us who know depression know this realm.
Let's see. Page 27, it starts with around you. Okay. Around the hot and cold hells are bands of surrounding hells through which beings must pass to get out of the hell realm. From afar, these hells appear to offer sweet respite at long last. But as beings approach, they are bitterly disappointed. What appears to be a cool river from afar turns out to be a swamp full of stinking corpses. What appears to be a shady trench is actually a pit of embers. What appears to be a pleasant meadow is actually a plain of razors. And what appears to be a protective grove of trees turns out to be a forest of swords. So what you have to do to get to this place is to be overcome with hatred, anger, and aggression, and act out those impulses. But it doesn't have to be just physical violence. It can include deception, oppression, verbal abuse, and sexual misconduct. This is the realm that is the most separation between self and other. You know, you're really feeling quite separate from everything. The Buddha here is an indigo Buddha holding a vial of water and flame. So there's a cooling effect of patience and forgiveness and purification, the fire of practice. So one thing to do is to question the reality of this world. We are describing it to ourselves. This is a place that we put ourselves. And so we're separate from everybody else, but we're quite united with the image that we have that we're in hell. So you kind of want to flip those, you know, and put in some separation between you and this, you know, I'm in hell, and drop our anger and attachment to self. Next up is the hungry ghost realm. So this is the realm of dissatisfaction. This is the one where celebrated, but I don't know if that's the right thing exactly in Sagaki. It is looking outside to satisfy the craving within. So it's a place of addiction, compulsion, obsession, or just plain whining. These are beings that are desperate for truth but are unable to accept the teaching. So they've got small mouths, little tiny necks that can't swallow anything. So they want, you know, they're hungry and thirsty, but they can't swallow it. And they've got big bellies, like malnourished people. And it's a worldview based on lack. What you do to land in this realm is to exhibit extreme selfishness and greed, and refuse to share blessings. So the Buddha here is a red Buddha, and it has a container of celestial nourishment. So one of the things we do in the Sagaki festival is encourage these beings by offerings dedicated especially for them, and they might accept that, or at least a little bit of it. The world looks very bleak and barren, can't get no satisfaction. It's like a bottomless pit of need, and they're like begging other people to do something for them. They're plucking at their sleeve, please. There is real lack in the world, but this is something different. You know, this is not being able to accept it if there is something offered to you that would help. So the last one is the human realm. And that's this world here and now. It's got a lot of the same elements as the other realms. It's a world of realm of constant change, a source of much suffering and also much happiness. There are some uniquely human kinds of suffering that are identified. Birth, and that could be any beginning that with its awkwardness and stress. Old age, illness, death. Gee, these sound familiar, don't they? Being separated from loved ones, meeting those not dear to us, not getting what we want, and having to guard our possessions. There is, you know, a focus in this realm on intimacy and love, which also leads to joy and misery, closeness and separation, ideal and disappointment, and vitality, and degeneration and death. So there's a whole spectrum here. What you do to get into this realm is to have some merits and some shortcomings. So it's a little of this and a little of that. It is considered the most advantageous realm to be in. I have read that, you know, this is the only realm where you can reach nirvana and step off the wheel. But I don't believe that, and I've seen it supported in other documents, that you can in any realm. But this is the human realm is that where it is easiest, closest to be able to get to that.
Easier to hear the Dharma and to practice.
Because you're not so caught up in misery or joy in heaven. The people in heaven don't have any incentive really to practice because they have everything they want. So there's just enough dissatisfaction in the human realm to make you go, well, what else is there? What's going on here? What should I do? The Buddha here is a yellow Buddha holding out a begging bowl representing spiritual practice and renunciation and stepping off the wheel. I have a... do I have a little more time or do you want to...
As you wish.
You're so nice. I saw something from Uchiyama Roshi that six ways not to approach meditation from the perspective of the six realms. So this is just like... I'm going to go through it quickly, and I would just say that the six realms are not going to be the same for all of us. We're going to experience them a little bit differently. So these might not exactly be yours, but maybe it'll spark some thinking about, you know, like using a vocabulary word in a sentence kind of approach. So he starts off with the hell realm. He says, sometimes we feel like we're forced to sit, like we don't want to be there and we have to, and so we're focusing on basically, you know, it feels like torture. When is that bell going to ring? And the antidote to that is to realize we've chosen it. We've chosen to be there. We could stand up if we need to and move. The hungry ghost realm meditation, we're greedy for results. We're looking for something to satisfy us. So, you know, the antidote to that that he's suggesting is to look at the lack that drives the desperation and learn to be present with it and sit with it. And that can transform into contentment and peace. Animal realm meditation. Animals, it's like the person finds a way to be comfortable and they just sit there. And nothing much is happening. They're just sitting there. It's a nice rest, but no insight and no deeper experience. And this dullness is hard to overcome. It's hard to recognize. So the recommendation here is to consult with a teacher who might be able to shake you up. The Asura's realm meditation is who can sit longest? Who can sit most still? How many hours did you put in? And so the question there is, this isn't me, but you can see other people, you know, would do these things. So it's like, who am I trying to beat and why? You know, just to ask yourself, kind of like as you get caught up in these, like, what's going on? In the Deva realm meditation, it's somebody who wants to be a saint. Above it all, removed from the messiness of regular life. And, you know, the feeling of if only certain conditions were met, then I could really practice. And this is like kind of an avoidance mechanism of dealing with, like, right now. And so it's a matter of questioning feelings of superiority and just coming back to right here, right now. The human realm meditation is a desire for results. You know, we want some practical application to this. And a lot of meditation instruction is presented that way. Sort of, it's scientifically, it's good for you and it will make you calm and more effective at work. And so there's nothing wrong with that, but it's just, you know, the focus is on sort of what you're going to get out of it. And that one is give up all hope for results and just be completely here. So those are the realms. Are there any more questions?
Yeah. So these are basically aspects of mind in the present, right? Mm-hmm. Being in one of those places at any point in time based on our consciousness. Because a lot of some traditional Tibet traditions would say that those are literal places. The
right.
Hell realms really exist.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Your karma is going to land you in the hell realm and the chakra teeth realm. So that, I just wanted to understand
could be,
that distinction.
Yeah, could be, it depends on the context and which tradition you're talking about.
Right.
We're not necessarily human at any given moment.
Sorry?
We're not necessarily human at any given moment. We could be in a hell realm or an animal realm or a deva or...
We can be both human and in hell.
I think that the way I've heard the human realm described is that it contains the others. So there's a way of being in the human realm where we can also be in a hell realm.
It's not just one or another. It's kind of
don't try to concretize it.
Well, sometimes it feels like I had an experience a minute ago of eating a few Musketeers bar, and I was like, that was really heaven realm.
Mm-hmm.
But you're saying not just that.
Heavenly music.
Heavenly music.
So, if you get sick with pneumonia and you've got a temperature of 102, you are not thinking, you are not analyzing, you are not striving for anything. You're just an animal trying to get better.
Right.
You're totally a body at that point. And, yeah, you're human. It's a human body, but it's not a human mind.
Yeah, I guess that's what I'm asking. Like, we are, like, homo sapiens.
Yeah.
We've got this body. But what the drawing is showing is that our experience of life goes from one to the other.
Yeah.
So any given moment, we could be a deva or a whole realm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. And when I was depressed, I was in hell for at least 2.5 years.
Yeah.
There was not a whole lot else going on.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's my experience too.
Yeah.
I'm curious that the special kind of hell. That involves paranoia, anxiety, fear.
Sure.
And I would expect it would be in the hell realm, but I kind of didn't hear that.
I think Domyo and Kengan have given you just a slice of what the hell realm is like, and there are places where the hell realm and the animal realm and the preta realm, the hungry ghost realm,
mm-hmm.
kind of morph into each other. They have elements of each other. So, unlike my Vajrayana friends, I'm very big on not concretizing any of this too closely, but using this as a guideline to just to notice, just as a kind of a template through which you can view some of the things that we get into and the places where we get stuck in particular. I mean, the fact is that we're going to touch all of these realms on any given day to some extent. But there are elements here that are particularly attractive to different personalities.
Mm-hmm.
And we tend to gravitate into those, and those are places we get stuck. And so being able to recognize the something about it, the iconography, the metaphor, the however you want to interpret it, that if there's something there that can be a little warning light for you, it's like, oh, I'm acting kind of like an Asura here, and maybe not necessary.
Yeah, the other thing I was thinking, listening to all those, is that you talked a little bit about going in, how you get there and how you leave, and to me, and maybe it's why I talk about fear too, but there's a path of experience there that's actually kind of common, which is some attachment,
mm-hmm.
and then an awareness, and then a let it go, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed, it, I imagine there's quite a bit of tradition discussing the paths through these realms
well,
like that.
One of our ancestors, Bodhidharma, talked about the phrase just dropped out of my head without words. Yeah, but there's a Zen is a path without words, and yet we have volumes of words talking about how this can't be described in words. And I will continue to try to describe in words things that can't be described in words. I'm going to move on to make sure we get into this. I'm going to give you some more vocabulary words. And the first one is karma. And that has been adopted by popular culture. But it's the way it's been adopted by popular culture, karma means bad stuff happens to bad people. And that's not what it means. So karma actually just means action. And there is both kusala and akusala karma. So kusala is meritorious action. So any action, and by action we mean any movement of your mind, your mouth, or your body. So it's pretty inclusive here. Any action that does not cause harm, that does something good, does something good for other people, clarifies truth. All of these things are meritorious. Akusala karma is bad karma. That is action that has a fruit that causes harm to self or other, causes division, causes confusion in the world, and one of the keys to karma is that it has to be volitional. And it doesn't mean that you have to desire that you're going to hurt somebody, but it does mean that there was a willful act. There was a decision made to do something. So you can make a decision to drive drunk and hit somebody. And because you didn't set out to hit somebody with your truck, But you made the decision to get behind the wheel. So karma accrues because there was volition there. But if you are the butterfly in Kansas that flaps its wings and participate in causing a hurricane that devastates Haiti, there is no karma that accrues to that butterfly. There was not a volition there that can be traced. So body, speech, and mind. In some ways, all karma is mind-related because volition is important to this, and volition comes from the mind. So even though some karma is acted out with the body, and a lot of karma these days is acted out with the mouth, originally the source of that fruit comes back to an act of the mind, a decision. So what the law of karma, and we talk about it as a law, the law of karma says that every cause has prior causes and conditions, and every fruit has prior causes and conditions, and every fruit and every karma is causes and conditions for something more. So there is this constant linking of cause and condition and fruit. And that is what is being illustrated here, is the way things can link together and cascade into a forever rotating faster and faster around this set of realms by not being aware, by not being disciplined, by not making the effort to restrain that which should be restrained, and not making the effort to do things that will move us in a better direction. So when I'm teaching people about dealing with personal karma and the habit energy that comes with patterns of karma, one of the things I say is that you can't just make up your mind, oh, I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm going to do this other thing instead. What you're trying to do is stop a train. And there is so much momentum there that you can't just decide you're going to stand on the tracks and stop the train. Mm-hmm. What you have to do is start bringing your awareness to that momentum, piece by piece by piece, until you can slow it down. And I will say this about meditation, is that the practice of meditation gives you, particularly if you put some energy into it, and you're not just doing animal realm meditation and dozing there, if you're putting some energy into it, you're actually learning to work with the mind. And as you bring awareness to the functioning of the mind, you find that you can slow down the process between one thought and the next thought and the next thought until there are tiny little gaps in that chain of thought patterns. Well, this is creating little breaks in this cascade effect, so that at some point you can assert your will and say, I don't have to escalate this. Maybe I can even de-escalate this. I don't have to escalate my rage. I don't have to feel righteous right now. I can step back a little bit and view this with a little more perspective. I can actually calm my heart rate a little bit. I can actually slow my breathing a little bit. And I can create more space around whatever this issue is that I'm getting invested in or worked up around. If you read the Dhammapada, which is some of the oldest stuff ever written down, the advice in that, one of the things the Buddha says is a fletcher bends the wood to make a bow. And somebody else directs the water for his irrigation. Well, the task we are setting ourselves is to bend the mind. So Buddhism is very practical. It's not dealing with something theoretical and distant and metaphysical. And, it's dealing with what is inside this bag of skin. What is this functioning between my ears that is causing me so much suffering? Buddhism is all about helping us to do the work that we need to do to reduce the amount of suffering that we create for ourselves and that we create for others. So learning to bend the mind a little bit, slow it down so we can catch karma as it arises, and sometimes reduce the size of the fruit that comes out of that set of actions. So in English we have the metaphor of the chicken and the egg, which comes first, the chicken or the egg. In Buddhist literature, they play the same game with seed, sprout, plant, flower, seed. Which comes first? The seed or the sprout? The flower or the seed? And ultimately, the Buddha says, okay, don't go there. You spend too much time thinking about first causes. You're getting lost in something metaphysical and unknowable. And what you can know right now is that if I kick the door, my toe is going to hurt. I can know certain things that are real and present now. And I can start learning to trace causes and conditions that are causing me harm, that are causing my family harm, that are causing difficulties. Another metaphor that is used around karma, and Nagarjuna apparently is the one that is credited with this. He said that the fruit of karma is inevitable. And he said it's like signing a promissory note. As soon as you make an action, you have signed papers for a loan. And even if the papers get destroyed or lost, you still owe that debt. You contracted that debt. And that will go on forever until it is satisfied. So that sounds pretty sticky. One of the things that gets even stickier is when we talk about, what do you mean forever? I'm only going to last 80 years, 90 years, 100 years, whatever. I should live so long. We'll see. But there's going to be a limit. So if I murder and plunder right now, I'm not going to be around to reap that debt. Nah, no problem. That's somebody else's problem. I'm going to read you something. This is not... this is commentary. This isn't scripture. The present chapter begins with one of the most popularly held misconceptions about the Buddha's teaching pertaining to rebirth. Punabhava, if anybody's taking notes on terminology. Even during the Buddha's day, when he spoke about rebirth being causally conditioned or dependently arisen, and enumerated several conditions that would contribute to it, one of his disciples picked out one among the conditions, namely consciousness, maintaining that it is this very same consciousness that transmigrates, not another consciousness. There certainly were many others, including some of his disciples, who continued to uphold such views through the centuries. The widespread prevalence of this view seems to indicate the adamant way in which people believed that for survival to take place, there must be a permanent and eternal substance. The Buddha's answer to these believers in a permanent and eternal self or entity is that any factor that contributes to human survival, whether it is consciousness or disposition or action or even grasping, all these are dependently arisen. For the Buddha, continuity can be explained in a more empirical way by following the principle of dependence of impermanent factors of existence, where one leaves an impression on another, thus eliminating the need for assuming a permanent entity. So this is getting a little philosophical, metaphysical here, but what I want to point out is that another piece of terminology is that we try to be very careful to talk about rebirth, not reincarnation. And the way that we parse this, and not everybody does it this way, but the way that we use this is that reincarnation is this presupposition that there is some little seed, some entity that gets transferred from Gyokoko when she dies to a chipmunk. And that... and that chipmunk is carrying whatever karma I have left over from this life. And rebirth is... less concrete, in that there is nothing concrete here, and so the karma that I am accruing in this life and not dealing with appropriately is leaving its mark, and that mark will exist after I'm gone. And yet that mark will affect people. people, animals, and plants. It will affect the world in some way that I can't predict or
control
or explain. But I trust it. And when we get back to the seed, the sprout, the plant, the flower, the seed, the sprout, the flower, one of the things that we can see in newborn children is that they have marks on them from the beginning. They are not totally blank slates. And some babies are marked more than others. And so if you just take this idea that there is marking happening, and it is this action and fruit happening around the world, and it is leaving marks. It's not the same as this particular seed planting that particular sprout, planting that particular, and that there is a linear progression there. But there is something that happens, and there is such a thing as collective karma and collective fruit. Phala is phala, is fruit or result of karma. Anyway, so Nagarjuna has gone through a lot of explication of and challenging these different ideas about birth and death, and what's causal and what's result. But it's too theoretical, and I really think that what is useful is coming back to the idea that everything that we do has a result, and because of that, and the Buddha emphasized this over and over again, we have responsibility. We have responsibility over what we think, over what we say, and what we do with our bodies. And that responsibility has consequences for us and for everyone around us. And if we want to just look at the consequences it has on us, we go a long way toward motivating ourselves to do the practice, to start being the Fletcher that bends the wood to make the bow. So all of this rich, gaudy even, teaching here is about how this progression of karma can take us from a really pleasant state to a really unpleasant state, but that we actually have, if not control, we have influence on how that goes. And if you don't have to be doing Buddhist practice to figure this out, if you just work on keeping the precepts or the commandments or, you know, some discipline that helps you take other people into account, to work on kindness, to work on awareness, some basic principles like that, it helps. I happen to think that the practice that we have inherited from our Buddhist tradition is a really powerful tool, and that it's very effective at helping us navigate this. When we get into dependent origination, we're going to talk about the steps that are described on the outside here, but I also, before next week, I want to find the way you turn it around. Because there are 12 steps of dependent origination, and then there are 12 steps of, and I forget what it's called, but anyway, it's the way we start evolving ourselves instead of just letting ourselves be driven. Good job. So, that's my preaching for today. Any questions or comments? Or...
I have a comment. So I'm always trying to map the things that you're talking about onto things that I've learned. This may not be exactly the same, but I do think it illustrates some points. So in the field of traumatology, it has been shown that young girls who grow up in traumatic, difficult, stressful environments sexually mature faster. Hmm. And that one of the thoughts is that it's a signal to the body that you may not be around long, mm-hmm. and you better procreate and reproduce as soon as possible. But what's also shown is that their offspring and that their offspring are deeply affected by this process. At a simpler level, just a psychological level, it's also shown that if you have a parent with a history of trauma, that trauma lasts about 3 to 4 generations. And that it affects the children at a physiological level and at a deep psychological level. These things are passed on. These are natural processes in the universe. That everything has multiple layers of causation that are played out forever. It's very rich.
Sobering.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, what question is that? Volitional part.
Yeah.
I find that it's in many cases very difficult to know what is going to be good, like what is going to have a good impact on other people, on anything. Like I can put forth great effort and do what I think is going to be good for somebody, and it's just not at all the right thing. And I've had many experiences like this. So so you're saying that it only, like, an action only carries karma if it's volitional, but it doesn't seem like that's the way that the world, it seems like the consequences of what we do go out into the world and on, whether it's connected to a good intention or not, doesn't really seem to affect that.
So the volitional part is not about if you have a good intention, you're going to get a good result. It's about if you have an intention. If you make a decision, then there suddenly there is karma accruing.
Okay.
So do you know about this is kind of funny, but we had a thing at the Abbey we called Bubu Bodhisattva. It's where you have this really great intention and you go in with great enthusiasm and you just muck things up royally. Well, this has been done on, you know, massive scales by well-intentioned NGOs going into Africa or something. It's just, you know, really stupid stuff with really good intention. But we do it all the time, you know, locally, personally. So the karma accrues, even though, you know, what we thought we were doing was going to be good. We don't have that kind of control where we and actually we don't have control. That's the great thing. So when you just accept the fact that you don't have control, it actually gets easier.
Yes.
So you have influence, and where you get, where you have influence mostly is right here inside this bag of flesh. So if you can influence your mind to be open, if you can influence your mind to allow the possibility that there might be another perspective, if you can open your mind to the possibility that you're not the only one in the room that has needs, you know, there are different ways of opening the mind. There are different ways of opening the mouth. We have a lot of influence about how much harm we create interpersonally just by how we express ourselves. And it's one of my great hobby horses, I guess, is that people try to say that words don't do harm. And I think that the more you believe that, the more really akusala karma you are spewing out into the world. And it has layers of effect. Anyway, down off the hobby horse. You have influence over what your body does. And that, I love it, because when we do something with our bodies, it's the most overt. When we really, you know, when you hold back and slug somebody, you know, it's not like you can take it back. It's not like you can pretend about it. It's just, it's out there for all the world to see, including yourself. And so the stuff that we do with our bodies is in a way the grossest. The stuff that we do in our minds is kind of, I can say nice things to you and still be thinking, there. Is she really going to wear that color? There. You know, I can. I remember when I was still in grade school, I heard that one of the girls I knew was in the hospital, and I blurted out, "Well, so what? I hope she dies." My mother came down on me like a ton of bricks, let me tell you. I was not to say that. I was not to think that about anybody, ever. And it was a really timely lesson. Uh-oh. Speaking of time. So, yeah. You have influence. But don't expect control.
Sigh.
Okay, Vespers.